actually the natural world. And I want to go back to something, a phrase that you use, radical intimacy, Brooke. And you really talk about this, I believe, in relationship to your travels to Galapagos Islands and how actually that changed. When you were there, you were reading Darwin, and you thought you were going to be a mechanical engineer in college, and you changed your whole your view and became a biology major. So talk about your time on Galapagos and how that changed you.
So my decision to not be an engineer goes back a little further than the Galapagos, but Darwin was always a real hero of mine. And I think it was because he and I had a lot in common. We both had fathers who had big dreams for us in terms of my father wanted me to be an engineer and his father wanted him to be a doctor. And he just couldn't deal with it. And he tried a lot of different ways to do that. He tried a lot of other things. But when this opportunity for him came that this ship was going to go travel the world and it needed a person like him, a naturalist, to come along, and he got the job and went on this voyage, and it changed the world. It was supposed to be like a 2 to 3 year voyage. It ended up being 5. And it was those days in the Galapagos that completely turned him upside down. The term radical intimacy, I read it first in a book by Lyanda Haupt about Darwin's bird journals. And she brought this to my attention. I never really knew how much Darwin sort of attributed mystical energy to things because he was so scientific and so methodical. But she used the term radical intimacy, that something shifted for him in the Galapagos when he saw these creatures that had no existence anywhere else, that had evolved there, and they were right there in front of him. Something really shifted for him. And the same thing happens to many people that visit the Galapagos. It's really a magical place. And you realize that something bigger than anything we can possibly imagine took place there. And it's the place where we go to view evolution in process. And it really gives you a different kind of hope. I think radical intimacy is a different kind of hope that beyond us, something is at play that we cannot control, and that it's all about adaptation to conditions. And I've thought about it ever since, that we can't really think that everything is going to improve as we go into the future, because we can see that's not. But we have so many issues now, and our biggest challenge is how we adapt to the changes that we're facing. And I think about that every day, especially since the last election.
Exactly. I'm wondering, when I read that part and just imagined you there on Galapagos, and I know my mother in years past was able to visit Galapagos, and it's a place where humans have not become predators of the environment. In other words, so you can walk right up to a turtle or a dolphin or whatever. They're not afraid of humans. So you're walking among them in quite, I'm going to use the word, indigenous way. Is that a correct assumption?
I'm not sure exactly about the idea of an indigenous way, but that they would have to talk to us about that. But what I felt and what I experienced, which is pretty common, is that you're right. These animals are not threatened. They have not been hunted. They evolved there in their own niches. Humans are more of a curiosity to them in most cases. And I think there, you know, we can all talk about, always talk about how we are one species among many. But when you see how we've acted and the damage that we've done and the extinction rates that have increased so much since we've become so technically able, it's hard to imagine that we're one species among many. But there you really see it. and you feel it, and you realize that we are such a small part of the big world. And instead of being intimidating, it's really invigorating and exciting. And more than anything else, it's inspiring.
For sure. For sure. It must be. It must be. And thank you for bringing that back to us, that vision of it. And I'm wondering also, in your thoughts of enchantment and re-enchantment and bringing that into our lives, I know that you tell us that it requires our participation. So it's not like we passively just go through our lives. We actually need to be active in some way. In what way would you suggest that we become activated in reimagining or re-enchanting our lives?
Such a good question. I think a lot of it is based on one thing, and that's attention, how we pay attention. I think about that all the time. We say that, pay attention. How do we pay attention? But I think that attention is something that we need to be fully conscious of. And Jung coined the term synchronicity. And I think about that a lot. And I think a lot about what enchantment is just a shift in the point of view, where is something that grabs our attention. Is it just a coincidence, or is there a synchronicity to it, meaning a meaningful coincidence, which is the definition that Jung gave to synchronicity? So I always pay attention. If something attracts my attention, I have to ask myself, why did that? Why did that and not something else attract my attention? And I'm really starting to think about synchronicity and the meaningful coincidence and how it taps our unconscious and how it's really trying to help us. So synchronicity is one thing, and that is realizing that anything that you think of that comes to mind. I mean, how often have you heard stories or even experienced it yourself where for some reason, like somebody you went to college with comes up in your mind, like a memory, and then like a day later, they'll call you on the phone or something like that will happen. Or see a book in a friend's house, and then later that day you hear on the radio a review of that book. Do you just ignore it, or do you go buy the book thinking that that book, your unconscious, needs that book? I feel like our unconscious is so vast and so immense and so multidimensional that it has so much for us, and we completely have cut ourselves off from it. But it's not that hard to change that. And I think it's so valuable. And I think our unconscious, our collective unconscious in particular, is defined as, you know, our entire evolutionary history, including everything we ever needed to save ourselves. So wouldn't we be looking at every opportunity we had to open the door to that unconscious and see what it's there for us? What's our role? How can the planet make the best use of us? I think the answer is there.
And I'm thinking as you're saying that about synchronicity and all of that, first of all, I want to say, if people ask me, how do you know what programs to produce? And I use that idea of synchronicity. I wait for three things to show up. And when the third thing shows up from a different, like, disparate ways to my consciousness, I say, I need to pay attention to that. That wants my attention. So, and I like it that you talk about pay attention. And to pay for something, there's a reciprocity there. If we put out money, which represents our energy for something, then we get something back. So it's like putting out something to get something back.
You know, can I stop you right there?
Yes.
That is so profound. I love that idea that you pay attention because you need something back. You need some information. You need some help moving to the next step. You need something. I think that's so important to think about. And that attention is, it's not just like an optional, random thing that happens. It's big and it's huge and it's important.
Thank you. Thank you for underlining that. And I'm thinking at a synchronicity in your life, which happened at some point, which gave you a lot of comfort. And that was after Terry's brother died, and there was a moment that you and Terry were talking about his death or something. At that point, a dragonfly landed on your thigh. And years before, Dan had given you a paperweight of a dragonfly, and all of those things brought you comfort in some way. Can you describe that moment?
I mentioned earlier that for many cultures, dragonflies carry the souls of the dead, and I have no idea how they do it or what that means or why. But when you think about it, if cultures throughout history that are not really connected to each other have that same idea that dragonflies are associated with the dead, wouldn't there be something to it? I mean, wouldn't it make sense that even if we can't be, us modern American white people, even if we have no scientific proof of it, wouldn't we ask ourselves, isn't there something to that that makes that possible? But yeah, Dan had died, and we were down by the river. This dragonfly, we were sharing some writing with one of Terry's students, the three of us, and that dragonfly landed on there, and I had sort of written along those lines. So I just decided there's no other reason that that could have happened, that somehow Dan was nearby, or Dan was trying to say something to us, or Dan was trying to let us know that he was okay. And I couldn't divorce myself from that. But then I realized that a couple of years earlier, when my fascination had begun, we had had a Christmas party and gifts were exchanged. And Dan was given this paperweight with a dragonfly, a piece of art dragonfly on the top of it. And he didn't have much use for it, so he gave it to me because he knew how much I cared about dragonflies. And that connection, his death, the dragonfly, within a few months, within a month after he died, landing on my thigh, I can't. You can tell me, you can have everyone around me say that's ridiculous, that was a total coincidence, and I wouldn't believe it because my own experience suggests otherwise, and there's just no other way that I can explain it.
Exactly. And I know many people have described something like that in their lives. I'm here with Brooke Williams. He's the author of Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Brooke Williams. He's a nature writer and an environmental writer and an avid trekker of desert lands. And he takes us many times on his trips into the desert, which are just fascinating. And I know one of the things that you say about the desert is the veil is thin in the desert. And what do you mean about the veil is thin in the desert?
I'm just speaking from my own experience, I feel like, well, if you go back to the Desert Fathers, for instance, and I think, you know, I mean, I'm going to make a sort of a broad statement here, but most modern religions are rooted in these ancient hermits, anchorites, who lived in the desert and had these visions, and they ended up being, you know, gospel in many different ways. And I feel like there's something to that. And I feel like it may be the absence of sound is solitude, you know, the absence of any material goods. Those people felt like the more they suffered, the closer they were to God. So they, you know, they lived in rags, they ate very minimally. And there's a whole study of hermits. In fact, one of my books that I consider like a Bible to me is Red Pine's book called The Road to Heaven, Encounters with Chinese Hermits. And he made a practice of going around and visiting these hermits in China and writing down what they believed and how they lived. And that caused me to start looking into a lot of other writings about hermits. And it really was about solitude and landscape and nature, being close to nature. So there's something to that. If our major religions came from that, then why don't we go to the source of it and see what happens to us? And I think that that's not just me saying the veil is thin, but there must be something to that. If that many religious philosophies were rooted there in the desert.
But also you've written about that in so far as you take us on your treks and the insights that you're able to connect to without the distraction of, let's say, modern city life in some ways. You're closer to the stars in some ways. Just being able to see the night sky from horizon to horizon is a miracle, I must say.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Think about it. Now we're going to a lot of effort to create dark sky parks, dark sky communities, because we're realizing there's something to it, to be able to see the sky. And in a lot of cases, it's like people's hobby to have their telescope out, identify the constellations. They want to go to places where the sky is dark enough to where they can see the constellations and see the stars. I read something recently where only 10% of the population of the world can see the Milky Way. And that's because 90% of the population lives in places that the light pollution is too great to see the night sky. So we're starting to realize that it's a great thing. It's like another resource. But if you look at it that way, then you have to even go back or even a little deeper and realize that until recently in our history, we didn't have a lot to do at night. I mean, it got dark, and every night there was the sky. There was no pollution, light pollution. Once our fire died down, and we probably didn't want to waste a lot of wood keeping the fire going all night, but once the fire died down, that was nothing but the night sky. And think what that contributed to us. We can't put a finger on it. We can't document it. We can't write books about what happened to our brains when most of our history was spent gazing up at the night sky. And now we're cut off from it. So what does that mean? How are we being hurt by that? And what does reuniting ourselves with the night sky do to help us?
I'd also like to have you say something about the shift in your consciousness when you moved from, you know, as a biologist and looking at biology and seeing it is believing it, that kind of mentality, to believing it so you can see it.
Yeah. So like, for how often have we heard it, I have to see it to believe it, you know, to see. And I'm talking mainly about sort of mystical things. But I think you have to believe that there's another dimension out there in order to really see it. And like I said, this idea of enchantment to me is a shift in point of view, because I do believe that the world is enchanted, but we have just lost our connection to that. And we've been taught and told that it's not, that it's very cut and dried, and that there's nothing magical out there. In fact, people have told me that this is all a novelty, me thinking this way about dragonflies, because it's not true. There's nothing to them. This is, you believe something that's not true. We don't think like this anymore. But once you start thinking that maybe it is true, and you start believing that it is true, then the magic of the world is that it responds. It supports your vision. I teach this in college and at Colby, I mentioned, and I'm excited about it all the time, and I get very excited about it. I get to teach these students a whole semester of this, and partway through, you get half of them that are still rolling their eyes back and wondering, is this guy for real? Because I was just in my science class, and they wouldn't believe this at all. And I say to them, I say, you know, you may or may not believe any of this, but I will guarantee you one thing. If you start living this way, if you start living as though the world is enchanted, even if you don't believe if it really is, or even if you're not sure, but if you start living that way, your life is going to be much more interesting. I guarantee it. And nobody can argue with that.
I love that. Okay, so you're giving an assignment. Live as if the world is enchanted. It is magical. Which it is. Yeah. I mean, I am all of New Dimensions, all the interviews we do. I mean, everything really points to this. The invisible world is really among us, and it is interacting with us all the time. In, as you say, if we pay attention to it, if we give it our attention, if we say, okay, today I'm going to notice what wants to show up. And be surprised by it.
Yeah. You, who knows how deeply listening to New Dimensions all these years has affected me, because that's your whole basis for being, is to promote the idea that what you see is only a small part of what really exists in the world. And that's what your whole mission is. And if the world is getting more enchanted at all, I think a lot of the credit goes to New Dimensions and a lot of people like you that have been talking about this for how long have you?
Yeah, 50 Michael? Years now. 50
50?
Years now.
Oh, God. Whoa.
Annie, it's been such a privilege, just an honor to just be with people like you that continue to remind us how to be present to the enchantment of just being alive and being in a physical body. And even in these times, we have an opportunity to make a difference, however it is. And don't think it's small. Don't
right.
think it's small.
Yeah. And, you know, my question, Justine, and maybe this is a good one for you, is I'm sure that there's an argument to be made that what the conversation that you and I are having right now is sort of preaching to the choir, that there's a lot of people that will listen to this program and they'll go, yeah, that's, I know that's true. I believe that. And I'm happy about that. And my goal is to think about how to extend this conversation into a broader ripple. And I really feel like if we have to think about one positive thing that's happening in our political situation, it may be that more and more people are finally going to go, something is missing. Something is happening to our world that does not make sense, and that we need to tap into some kind of energy, some kind of knowledge that we don't currently tap into. And that the things that you and I are talking about, I believe, is that kind of knowledge. I mean, I don't know if Einstein really said you can't solve today's problems with the same consciousness that you created them with. I don't know if that's the quote or if it's apocryphal and he didn't really say that, but I believe it's true that we're trying to solve the problems with the same information, the same knowledge, that the same consciousness that we cause them with. What we're talking about is a different kind of consciousness. And if we can make the case that it's real and it's a lot deeper and a lot older and a lot more, it's been tested for much longer than any other, we may get somewhere.
May it be so. Well said. Oh, Brooke, I want to thank you so much for being with us once more with this stimulating conversation. I've been speaking with Brooke Williams. He is the author of Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, brookewilliams.site, S-I-T-E. And he spells his first name B-R-O-O-K-E, brookewilliams.site, S-I-T-E. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3835.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, my name is Shiv Singh, co-author of Savvy. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about navigating fake companies, fake leaders, and fake news in the post-trust era.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.